So, hello and welcome to the Voices of Awareness podcast. I'm Andy Taylor, and today my guest is Richard Scorer, the author of Betrayed, The English Catholic Church and the Sex Abuse Crisis, published in 2015. Richard is a solicitor at Slater & Gordon who specialises in representing survivors. Betrayed is dedicated to those many survivors of abuse brave enough to come forward and tell their stories, and others who may yet do so. Richard, thanks very much for joining me today. I'm just wondering, has the courage of survivors who have told their stories inspired an authentic cultural shift in the Roman Catholic Church?
That's a really interesting question, and I guess a very big question. I mean, there's no doubt that the whole reason that we've got to this point of having a lot of public and media focus on Catholic abuse scandals is because of the courage and determination of survivors. Of course, we have a responsibility as a society to be there and support that, and to make sure that allegations are taken seriously and investigated properly. And of course, for many years, that didn't happen. A number of changes have come together. We've got to a position where, certainly in many Western countries, there is much more public awareness of what's gone on within the Catholic Church and indeed in other churches.
I'm noticing how that doesn't necessarily correlate with what we hear in the news about the Roman Catholic Church. The last piece of news is about the conviction of Father Joseph Quigley, is that right?
That's right.
Who has been convicted for 11 years, but the process has taken 20 years, is that right?
Yes, and I think that, anybody who is kind of remotely complacent about child abuse, clerical child abuse, needs to look at what happened in that case, and because it's the events that occurred in that case are really quite recent. The client that I'm representing in that case was abused between 2006 and 2009 by Quigley, and without going obviously into confidential detail, that happened over a period of 3 years, and then simultaneously to that, the Catholic Church in Birmingham was becoming aware of other allegations against Quigley. And we've heard a lot from the Catholic Church, particularly since 2001, which is sort of where they draw the dividing line. And they say, well, we did bad things prior to 2001, but post-2001, we've been very good about reporting allegations like this to the statutory authorities, to the police and so on.
Yeah.
But it seems pretty clear in the Quigley case that although the Church was aware of allegations against Quigley, certainly in 2008, possibly before actually, and we're looking into that, it seems very clear that the police were not properly informed about what they had discovered. And Quigley was sent off for treatment, a lengthy period of treatment in America. Something was sufficiently serious to justify sending him for treatment in America for a number of months, then you would think that it would be sufficiently serious to report to the police.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And what we've also learnt from the account of one of the survivors, and this is corroborated by a family member who was present at the same meeting, is that one of the survivors was strongly discouraged from taking his allegations to the police. This was in 2012, I think. But the person doing the discouraging was the safeguarding officer, or so-called safeguarding officer, for the Archdiocese of Birmingham. Although, the Catholic Church has been saying, we've reformed, we've changed, we bring in the police whenever we discover something, the reality is that didn't happen in that case, and that case is very recent.
That's disturbing for me to hear, because of the way it is similar to the kind of culture of do as I say, but not as I do, the justified disgust in that has got to a point that Cardinal Nichols is being asked by survivors to resign.
People have been calling for Cardinal Nichols to resign for some time before that.
Okay.
I think the Quigley case absolutely reinforces all of the concerns that we have about Cardinal Nichols, because he was, of course, before he became Archbishop of Westminster, he was Archbishop of Birmingham for a number of years, and that included some of that time when the Quigley issue was being dealt with. He was also, as I understand it, a close friend of Quigley's. Right. So you have to sort of wonder whether, you know, there was some element of special treatment being accorded to Quigley, but who knows? But everything that's come out about the Quigley case absolutely reinforces all the issues about Cardinal Nichols, but those were there already. And the reason they were there already is because the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse had investigated the way in which he personally, and it's important to say this, the way in which he personally had handled various cases in both Birmingham and in the Diocese of Westminster, where he was subsequently. And so when the inquiry report came out last year, I mean, I tried to make the point as strongly as I could that this was not a case of Cardinal Nichols being held to account for other people's failings in the church that he led.
Right.
This was survivors saying he has to go because his personal handling or mishandling of cases is so serious. So, you know, he cannot any longer be a credible leader of a church that is purporting to take safeguarding seriously, because in the cases that he was personally dealing with, he didn't take it seriously.
Why is he not resigning?
Why won't he resign? It's a good question. I mean, the first thing to say about that is the role of Pope Francis in this, because Pope Francis has, been saying that, you know, he was determined to root out child abuse. And the reality is that that hasn't happened. His rhetoric about doing it has not been remotely matched by the reality. And so when the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse was investigating St. Benedict's and what happened there, and there's a Vatican connection to that the inquiry wanted to explore, they asked the Vatican for cooperation on that, and that was refused. Pope Francis has, you know, been very, very strong on the rhetoric of tackling clerical sex abuse. Mm. In practice, he hasn't wanted to do the things that would enable that to happen. And I think the same applies to Cardinal Nichols. I don't know, obviously, why he specifically wants to keep Nichols in place. And maybe it's a situation where he just doesn't think there's a viable alternative. There isn't somebody else who can step up into the role. I don't know whether that's the issue, but from my point of view, and I think from the point of view of many survivors, given that Nicola's failed so badly, he just ought to go. Why that's happened, I just don't know. I don't know whether it's...
Is that something that we're ever likely to know, or is that something that will stay behind an opaque wall?
I think it's going to stay behind a wall, isn't it? Because the Catholic Church is an entirely unaccountable institution, and, you know, it's not a democratic institution, and nobody gets to know what's going on. And the Catholics who attend church on Sunday and, you know, contribute to the collection plate and so on, have no say in how the money's spent and how the church is governed. It's not a democratic institution, and it's not a transparent institution.
Right.
So we're never going to know what the reasons are. All we can say is that it's really quite shocking and appalling that, you know, he's still in that job given the failings that he's been responsible for.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the congregation, people who are actually turning up to church now. I know that some people that I've spoken to, this whole mishandling and the cover-up and the denial of the sexual abuse crisis has completely put them off the church, understandably. I'm surprised that hasn't encouraged the church to start behaving in ways that are much more walking the talk rather than, talking the talk and then walking something else.
I agree. And I mean, the most extreme example of this, I think, is Ireland, where the obviously, you know, if you go back 30 or 40 years, Ireland was overwhelmingly, not only an overwhelmingly Catholic country, but a very devout one. And, you know, there was a huge social expectation that you would go to church, and that obviously all sort of fell apart under the impact of abuse scandals. Now the church, not only is it struggling to, you know, maintain the congregations, but it's struggling even to recruit, you know, new priests,
right?
And it's having to merge parishes and so on. So it's on, you know, a very dramatic downward path in Ireland.
So it's almost on a kind of an extinction journey, just as the planet is.
I think that probably would be, you know, the reality of it in Ireland. But then when you look in other parts of the world, of course, where these scandals haven't had the same impact, you know, there are other parts of the world where Catholic populations are probably growing. And so the Catholic Church, being a sort of multinational institution, I think has a sort of a particular attitude about this, that somebody said, you know, the Catholic Church sort of thinks in centuries rather than in years or even decades. And, right. you know, the fact that, you know, over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, there have been all these scandals, and the reputation of the Catholic Church has been so badly impacted by it. I think there are, you know, people in the Vatican who would just say, well, that's, you know, that's happening now, but, you know, we think in centuries. And in any event, to the extent that it's happening in Western countries, not all across the world. So I think there is an arrogance about their response to this. The first sort of major case that I was involved in on this was the case of Father Michael Hill, was a priest down in Arundel and Brighton. And the significance of that case was that the decisions that were made about him, this was in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, those decisions were made by Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who at that time was Bishop of Arundel and Brighton, but later became head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales. And at the point at which he became head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, this sort of scandal about how he had dealt with the Michael Hill case came to light. But and I acted for some of the victims on that. In fact, I think the majority of them. And we did settle the compensation cases, but what had the big impact on the Catholic Church was not the settlement of the compensation claims. It was the fact that all of this public and media exposure of how Cormac Murphy O'Connor had behaved.
There's the crime of the perpetrator, and then there's the moral crime of the cover-up that occurred in the church, which, although perhaps has only been noticed through exposure in the last 30 years, presumably was, you know, kind of protocol for centuries as well. The hardest thing to digest about that for me is the way that perpetrators were just transferred into other parishes and other communities without warning those communities of the risk to children. And they then reoffended, and nothing was done by whoever that leader was who made that decision to prevent further offence by known sex offenders.
Yeah.
Short of rolling a bomb into a parish or, you know, going in with a machine gun, that is a very, very violent thing to do. But it's not a crime in any sense in the UK, is it?
No, and it ought to be a crime. And when you were, you know, using that analogy of rolling a bomb into a community, I was thinking about the case of Father Gregory Carroll, who was, I mean, he was convicted back in 2005, and then he was convicted again, I think, last year for very serious sexual offences against children. And this, I mean, his case was a very good illustration of this. He was a teacher on priest at Ampleforth College. When it was discovered that he was abusing children there, he was sent off to an Ampleforth mission parish on the Cumbrian coast. So having sort of been discovered abusing boys in a posh elite public school community, he was then dumped on a working class parish in on the Cumbrian coast, where he then went on to abuse several other children. And, you know, that's an example of exactly the sort of thing you're describing. It ought to be a crime. And fundamentally what we need, and I go on about this so much that I sort of feel like a stuck record when I talk about it, but what we absolutely need to have in this country is a mandatory reporting law. In other words, a law that says that if you know or have reason, you know, good reason to suspect that somebody is abusing children, have a legal responsibility to report that to the statutory authorities, to the police, so that it can be investigated and dealt with. And unless and until we have a law like that, we will continue to carry the risk of these cover-ups. It's the absence of any kind of legal sanction for covering up abuse that allows abuse to be covered up. And it feels very wrong to me that despite, you know, all of these years of scandals coming to light, that still hasn't happened. I very much hope that the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse will recommend it. I can't guarantee that they will. We've made the arguments. We'll have to see what they say about it. There's certainly overwhelming evidence from the cases that they've looked at to show why that's necessary. You can be working in an institution, you can know that a child within that institution has been raped by a work colleague, and it is perfectly lawful to do absolutely nothing about that. And that's just entirely wrong on every level.
It's really, really disturbing to hear it when you describe it so vividly as that. And I think I heard 80% of the world have adopted mandatory reporting. Why is the UK so behind?
I think it's certainly true that a large number of countries do have mandatory reporting laws, and I certainly think the large majority of Western countries do. And I think the UK is an outlier in that respect. You know, we are behind everyone else in not having a law of this kind. Mm. Why we've got to that position, I'm not entirely sure, particularly given that there's been so much sort of you know, talk about it and campaigning for it. There is, and always has been, strong resistance to mandatory reporting in the social work profession for various reasons. But I think that the single biggest concern that social workers say that they have about this is the idea that if you have mandatory reporting, you will get a large increase in reports, and then that will overwhelm the system and you won't be able to deal with it. I think there's two things to say about that. The first thing is to say is if you have mandatory reporting, yes, you will get an increase in reports. I mean, that's why you have it. The point about getting those reports then is that you then investigate them and you then prevent further abuse down the line. So you make an investment in dealing with the evidence now rather than, you know, letting the abuser carry on and, you know, do more harm and do more damage. And then you then have to deal with that later on. So it's an investment in mandatory reporting as an investment in the future.
Mandatory reporting presumably would be a very great deterrent to any member of the clergy who was thinking that rather than reporting abuse to the police, that they would not.
That's absolutely right. And you have to remember that people working in institutions, and this applies to churches, but it also applies to other institutions, often come under tremendous pressure not to report. Mm. And what mandatory reporting does, I mean, you know, we've talked about criminal sanctions, but the ultimate aim of mandatory reporting is not actually to criminalise people. What the aim of mandatory reporting is to give people, in a sense, a refuge where they can say, well, you know, I have no choice but to report this. I have to do it because the law requires me to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't have any choice about it, and therefore I'm going to do it. And, you know, we have this in the solicitor's profession. So a few years ago, the bodies who regulate the legal profession decided that if we as solicitors come across evidence that somebody is involved in money laundering, We then have a legal duty to report that. And if I discover that a client is involved in money laundering and I don't report that to the authorities, then I can be struck off. And unsurprisingly, the result of this is that solicitors do report concerns or allegations about money laundering because they have to. They just do it. And what we've always said about mandatory reporting is that it will work in the same way. It will normalize the response of saying, you know, I've got this information. I just have to pass it on so that it can be looked into. Yeah. I don't even need to make a judgment about whether my concern is justified or not. I simply need to tell somebody and it gets reported and it gets dealt with by somebody who's equipped to deal with it.
Right.
And that's where we need to get to. And as I say, as I always say, I mean, I find it astonishing in a way that, you know, there can be laws requiring the mandatory reporting of money laundering or terrorism, for example.
Yeah.
But not child abuse. You know, child abuse is at least as harmful, if not more harmful, in its impact on society than terrorism and money laundering, both of which are obviously also very bad things. But child abuse is certainly no less serious, and it deserves to be treated in the same way by the legal system.
Absolutely. Well, this podcast, this is actually the first podcast that I've done, and I'm very honoured to have you as a guest.
It's been a real pleasure to take part. Thank you very much.
Thank you.